Hi guys, I'm Danan Hanbali, and this is Something to Consider. As you can tell from the direction of a lot of my episodes, I do enjoy conversations with entrepreneurs. I learn a lot from their experiences and always feel like there's something I can relate to. Entrepreneurship today is sort of the sexy, new age, young version of what the face of businesses and brands should aspire to look like. And it is a fact that entrepreneurship contributes significantly to job creation and plays a vital role in today's economies, with the energy they bring to innovation and the diversification of industries and sectors. That being said, we have an even bigger contributor to global economies that doesn't always get the same enthusiasm, and it is what I call legacy or family-owned businesses. To quote Tharawat magazine, it is estimated that family-owned businesses contribute more than half of the world's GDP and account for over 65% of its employment. Moreover, the 500 largest family enterprises generate over $8.02 trillion in annual revenue alone, collectively enough to be the third largest national economy after the United States and China. In 2022, a study came out from KPMG that family-owned businesses account for 90% of private companies in the UAE. I imagine we would find similar statistics across the Middle East, and even more so in the GCC. So, I went in search of the right person to have a conversation on this topic, and I stumbled across an absolute gem. Farid Al-Hagami is a lawyer, CEO, co-founder, contributes to her family's multiple businesses, is a governance expert, serves as an advisor on the board of other family businesses, and is also a founding member of the Global Women in Family Business Network. She speaks six languages, is a sustainability advocate, and a global citizen of both Dutch and Egyptian descent. So you can understand, with credentials like that, why we want to completely claim her as ours. Farida, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Dana. It's a pleasure to be here.
Honestly, it's a privilege to have you.
Thank you so much. I kind of feel shy now that I heard all these accolades. I'm going to try to live up to your expectations.
You already do. I almost feel like the theme song to Succession, though, should be playing in the background.
You know, I've never watched Succession.
What?
Yes.
How?
And I can't. It's because I've never watched legal, like, series
or dramas. So you haven't even seen Suits or
I cannot because I lose kind of patience because it's so not what the truth is. And
really?
But with Succession it's different because you recognize so many things and you actually recognize a lot of the things that bring so much pain to a lot of people in real life.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was hard for me to see. I watched one episode and I was like, no, I think I know where this is going.
Well, this sounds like the perfect start to our conversation. So I want to start with my opening question that I usually do on these episodes where I have a guest here. Can you walk us through your journey so far? I want to give the audience a bit of context about you. And then I'd love to know kind of pivotal moments that have shaped your path in relation to where you ended up in your family business?
A light question.
A very light question.
Fantastic. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me here. I really enjoy speaking to you and learning from you as well. So it's a privilege to be here with you. So in a nutshell, my background is mixed. So I'm half Dutch, half Egyptian, and grew up all my life in Switzerland. So neither in the Netherlands nor in Egypt, which obviously, you know, turns you into probably a forced global citizen initially, without really understanding what it means, because obviously your home is very different from everybody else's home, and not just because your parents are not Swiss, but also because both of your parents have two very distinct cultures. So even your other, let's say, immigrant friends would usually come from kind of one background. So you'd have, like, for example, Turkish or Spanish, you know, families living in Switzerland, but they would have two parents of the same culture. So in our case, it kind of added a bit of spice.
I had
that second
quite literally.
Literally. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So the Dutch food, but with Egyptian spices. So that's kind of the whole kind of start of my family's story. And I have two sisters. I'm the eldest of three. And yeah, we basically had a very straightforward Dutch Egyptian Swiss childhoods, Swiss schools, did our university education in Switzerland and in the UK. And I think so our immigrant background definitely got me to be interested in the legal system very early on, because I was very politically active as a young person. I did a lot of kind of activities in the community, and I started realizing that I wanted to really understand how society works, or how, let's say, one aspect of society works. And so I decided, I remember very well the day that I had to decide what to study. I was sitting at a desk in my room, and I had three papers in front of me. One was for archaeology. My father studied archaeology.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And so we grew up, you know, trying to find old excavation sites and see if we can find something, right?
In Switzerland?
In Switzerland, all over, wherever we went.
Okay.
So we would always kind of try and find nice places. So I was always fascinated by archaeology and kind of the history of civilizations, basically. And then the second one was medicine. My mom is a physiotherapist, so we've always been very kind of medically inclined in the family, with a lot of consciousness and awareness of kind of our biology. And the third one was law. And the law kind of won out. So I went to law school, both in Switzerland and in the UK, graduated, then decided that I wanted to practice. So I did the bar, took the bar, which ends up being an 8-year educational path, but definitely worth it. I loved practicing law. I think it's a privilege, you know, when you can be a voice for your clients, you know, whatever their situation is, you're very hands-on in terms of how you can help people when you're a lawyer. So I practiced in a general practice. So I did all sorts of things, family law, criminal law. But then I kind of started focusing on corporate administrative law and refugee law. So those were kind of the three areas that make no sense together, but made sense to me.
Oh my God. It really made
a lot of sense to me. And then fast forward a couple of years, my father set up, co-founded the Therawat Family Business Forum, which is a nonprofit private sector think tank here, based here in the UAE. And it was set up in 2006. And kind of until 2009, it was more of a, I would say, dinner club for, you know, families to get together. And then our chairman, who's not my father, felt that it was time to institutionalize. And so that was when I got the call if I wanted to come to the UAE and try and do this. And I found it a very interesting task. First of all, I had done research in the UAE. So I'd lived in the UAE for a little bit before, you know, taking this role. So I knew the country a little bit. But I also found it a very interesting kind of combination of both civil society work, because it's a nonprofit organization, but at the same time, the private sector aspect, which I find fascinating, and specifically in a dynamic environment like the Middle East, I think the private sector has such a pivotal role to play, you know, in how we shape. It actually shapes communities almost more than anything else, I would say, or in a different way, let's say.
Shapes and influences.
100%, 100%. And, you know, there are stories that I'm happy to share where we see specifically family businesses really sustain entire communities.
Wow.
And that's an amazing impact. So when I saw that, I'm like, you know what, that's actually an interesting combination. And then my sister also got a call from the same person, from my dad, saying that we also wanted to do a publication. And so she just graduated from business school. So we kind of, you know, showed up here not really knowing much about anything, but with a very clear vision of wanting to understand. And I think that is a trait in my family, is that we never assume that we know. We always want to try and understand first, you know, and learn from others.
I like that. So the publication was a result of institutionalizing Therawat.
Absolutely. And the reason why it became such a global publication, because now today it's a global publication alongside Women in Family Business, which were kind of then spin-offs of our activity working with families on a research perspective, is that we felt that a lot of people have a lot to say to and about these family businesses. Not many people really listen.
Yeah.
And when you stop and you listen, there is so much incredible know-how and understanding when enterprises last for more than one generation.
That's such a great way to put it, because I mean, there it's incredible learnings that have literally built economies and quite young economies, if we're referring to the Middle East. Let's take it from there. What is the most common misconception about family businesses?
Oh, there's a lot, I think. There's kind of misconceptions, I would say, on the positive and misconceptions on the negative side. So I would say that misconceptions on the positive is that, you know, everything comes easy to them because of the name, because they've established themselves and, you know, because of real or perceived wealth, let's be honest, that also for family members who carry the name of a big family, that things will come much easier. So that's kind of, in my opinion, a big misconception, because, you know, it's never easy. And sustaining a legacy is actually a very, very difficult job. It's very hard, and it's one of the hardest entrepreneurial activities, I would say, is to sustain a legacy. And then on the other hand, kind of the negative connotations is connotations of perhaps slowness, being very traditional, being not very innovative or exciting, right? That's why a lot of people navigate more towards startups rather than established businesses, because there is an excitement factor that we think we cannot find in a legacy business. Questions of nepotism, of course, you know, the advantage of family members within the organization. So there's a lot actually to deconstruct. I would say there's no smoke without fire, but I would say the fire is much smaller than people think in you both think? Cases. Yes.
Would you think, though, if we're, I mean, we're talking about, okay, so we're kind of generalizing family businesses here, and we're talking about two distinctively different markets that you are part of. Do you see a difference in terms of the culture that we're talking about? Because a lot of what you alluded to definitely are things that we talk about here. The fact that people inherit the roles that they end up getting to, as you said, and rightfully so, sustain that legacy. Does it function the same way in Europe? Are there the exact same perceptions? Or is there more of a, I don't want to say, it's admiration's the wrong word, but is there more of a revere for being part of that family business and it being more of something to aspire to versus here where it just feels like it's a privilege that you get?
So it's an interesting question, and I never really know how to answer it, because it's extremely generalizing, right? You generalize is something that you already generalized. So I find it hard to give you a proper answer. And unfortunately, there's very little research that I can quote for you to give you kind of data. But here's what I've observed. I think the combination of family and business yields very similar results at its core. And then the differences that we start seeing are influenced by culture, both the culture of the family and the culture of the country or the region that the people are a part of, the maturity of the market, right? How that plays into how much pressure are family enterprises under from the marketplace. The volatility, geopolitical volatility, that makes a huge difference. So there's a lot of factors that I think that at its core, every family business faces extremely similar challenges. It's just that, do you have access to tools to address them early on, for example? Do you have a very regulated or an under-regulated market? Because if you have a very regulated market, a lot of the, for example, governance questions, you don't have to really think about, because the market is asking you to regulate or to govern yourself, right? Because that's part of the regulation. When you're in an under-regulated market, it's, you know, basically free. You can do whatever you want. Well, if you don't do it, nobody's going to ask you. And that has a disadvantage as well. So I think those are the factors that then are going to kind of make the difference ultimately in how they ultimately look. But if we narrow down the core of most of the challenges that we see in family businesses, I would say they come from the same place.
What about the dynamic of collaborating with family members in these businesses? You have firsthand experience, and you've been privileged enough to have access to other businesses where you've been able to draw research and insights. What are kind of your findings or insights on the dynamics of working with siblings, does it work? How does one set boundaries in an environment like that, especially when they're going back to the same home after, in some of the cases?
I mean, I thought I'd had a tough job being a lawyer and, you know, representing clients that were in prison or, you know, going to court. It was tough, right?
Yeah.
But then working with family is a whole other ballgame. And, you know, I don't think there's any sugarcoating. I think anyone who's listening here and that has a family business will probably agree that it's probably one of the hardest things to do is to work with your family members. But I always describe it like it's like the extreme sport of work, right? It's like bungee jumping. Mm-hmm. Working with your family is like bungee jumping. On the one hand, it's like anxiety inducing, mm-hmm. right? And it's really, really, I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. And on the other hand, when it works and when you have good moments, it's exhilarating. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing, in my opinion, personal, humble experience, there is nothing that beats a moment of success that you can celebrate with your family members. Haven't experienced anything like that. And so it's a very tricky reality to deal with when you have people that you've known all your life, that have seen you as a child, that you have almost set social patterns with. Mm-hmm. And suddenly now you find yourself in a work environment. And one example is that, for example, even for myself, and I'm blessed, we have very beautiful family relationships. We put work into them, but they're amazing. But when I started working with my sisters, it was a hard year, the first year. And then suddenly we realized, hang on a second, we actually need to stop thinking that we know each other because we know each other as family. I personally, as the eldest, I had to start looking at my sisters as my colleagues and as equal professionals rather than my sisters with the whole kind of, you know, backpack of relationship that we already have. So it actually takes a lot of, in my opinion, to make it work, takes a lot of introspection. Mm. And what's hard is when you have a bigger family and you have more family members, and not everybody is introspective.
Yeah.
That's when it becomes difficult. And then when people's priorities differ, mm-hmm. when people's lifestyles differ, it takes amazing leadership to make this work. The flip side is, and this is why family businesses are so amazing, is there is very clear academic research that shows that family enterprises are actually much more resilient than non-family enterprises.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. You would think, based on all these challenges, right? You would think like, oh my God, collapse now.
Wow.
But there is something, and we've felt it ourselves, my sisters and I, and my parents as well. There is just something about being emotionally connected to the enterprise that you're working in that makes you endure things that you probably would not endure if this was not your legacy or if this was not your family enterprise.
Interesting. It's interesting because it falls into the thinking of, you know, you don't choose your family, but family is for life. So I imagine, I mean, just listening to it now, imagine making that choice in the people that you build a business with. I mean, what are the profound results that you know, you'd be led to as a result of that? I imagine they'd be profound.
Absolutely. I mean, I noticed it myself. I think one of the reasons I'm so comfortable with my co-founders in my startup is because we all three came from a family business. Mm. All three of us worked with our family members. Okay. And it's hard to work with your friends.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone who's ever tried it, very few of us actually make it through because it is really, really difficult. But I think the fact that each of us had to work with siblings, had to work with parents, we all have a higher level of tolerance for that kind of building of a trusted relationship because we know that that's the thing that's going to sustain. Everything else you can work on, but it's having basic and almost irreversible trust in each other. That's where it starts. And that's the currency of a family business is trust.
I love that. But I also think you said something so key, and it is making a conscious decision to be introspective and invest in your own personal yes. growth to get to a stage where you are able to go beyond the complexities that these relationships come with. Because because you make a decision to make it work doesn't mean it gets less complicated or less hard. So I think that's incredible. I'm curious, though, do you feel like when it came to your business in particular, and especially the fact that now you're working with your sisters, were there any specific foundational values that your parents invested in with you guys that maybe sort of helped in terms of that? Absolutely. And what were they?
Absolutely. I think there is a very specific culture that happens, I believe, when you grow up in an immigrant family. Mm. When you're not connected culturally to your environment, it can make you insular. But most of the time, there's a very clear kind of work ethic that comes out of it, right? Because you have to prove yourself. You have to continuously prove yourself because you don't belong, in a way, right? I mean, I believe I belong now in Switzerland, but it's something you need to work for.
Absolutely.
And I think that is one of the founding principles and we were lucky, and I'm always going to say that, we were lucky with my sisters that all three of us took to those values that my parents gave us in a similar fashion. Mm. Because what I've also seen is that because of different characters and different makeup of people, right, we react to the same stimuli in a very different way. And so when that happens, when you grow up in the same household, same values, but because of a certain character trait, you take those values in a different way, that's when it becomes harder. Mm-hmm. Not impossible, but that takes even more introspection and it takes more communication. So it's a combination, right? I believe, at least, this is how I, after 15 years of this, this is kind of how I look at it. It's a combination of honesty with oneself, and the capacity to communicate in a way that is supportive of the collective without devaluing myself. And this is the tension that we see in family business is very often me versus the collective. Mm-hmm. Where's the interest? Where? How do I weigh which interest? Mm. And very often we see people burning out as well. And, you know, we have to be honest about that because you put the collective forward more than your own interest. And that becomes something that if you do not address it, it can really fester and become bitter.
It's interesting because I actually wanted to talk to you about that. When we think about entrepreneurship, burnout is something that ends up being a result of that quote-unquote hustle. But also there's an incredibly heavy feeling of loneliness that one does feel on their journey to building a business. Would you say that would apply in a family business, or is the dynamic completely different because of the nature?
So the way I look at it is a little different. I think because we've spoken a lot about startups and, you know, and luckily we speak about mental health toll of running an enterprise or specifically a startup, I think it's very healthy. Mm-hmm. But the way I look at it is I was once sitting on a train in the Netherlands. It's a funny story. Because it really triggered a thought. And I was going to a meeting or something, and then I was sitting, and it was a really full train, and everybody was a bit angry, and this guy was sitting opposite me, and he was reading, like, a heavy book, and I always try to see what people read. I'm curious.
That's such a European thing.
Yeah, I know. And so he was reading a book, and it was like a psychological book or something. And then there was an incident. And anyways, we got to talking, and I'm like, so, you know, what are you reading? And he's like, oh, well, I'm a psychology professor, and I teach at the university in the town that we were going to. I'm like, oh, that's so interesting. What do you teach, or what do you research? And he was saying he was researching leadership loneliness. Mm. I was like, leadership loneliness? I had never heard it that concisely as a term, right? And I was like, wow, that's so interesting. And so he started explaining to me what he was researching more in a corporate context. So, you know, large corporates and how their hierarchies and structures lead to leadership loneliness. And I obviously naturally started applying it to entrepreneurship and family businesses. And so kind of to come to your question, I think I look at it from that angle at the moment. Mm-hmm. This is kind of where I am right now with that reflection. I think there is much more leadership loneliness than we think, because when we look at family businesses, you have 30 cousins, you have 20 uncles, everybody is around, you have, you know, dinners and lunches with each other. You don't look lonely.
Mm.
But on the inside, you can absolutely be very lonely. And I think part of what we try to do is to create communities of people that go through similar phases or challenges in this community, and show them that there is a community outside of the family that you can trust and that can trust you, that can slightly reduce that loneliness.
Interesting.
So I think that is something, it's difficult to talk about here in the region,
mm.
because, you know, loneliness is not something we perceive.
True. And also family is a very private subject. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting kind of interplay of, you know, how we see business and the role it plays in our lives and the dynamic of our family, both of which have a certain level of, you know, we don't talk about these things because Zayib, or it's not appropriate. But then, you know, you're kind of bringing to the table the acknowledgement of that. And so is it actually working? Has it changed the way that you guys are running your business internally by just talking about it?
That I can only speak about ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. So I can only share the experience that we have. I do think that we've learned a lot. And I'm lucky that at least the three of us as siblings, we realized at the same time that we have a responsibility towards each other to up the game.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, we realized it at the same time, and that was COVID.
Okay.
So it took COVID that completely obviously scrambled everything that we were doing, and every business that we were doing was affected. And our reaction was, and this is the time to work on our communication. So rather than running to, of course, we wanted to save the businesses and we had to make sure that everything, you know, our teams were okay, etc. But in terms of internally, we were not working on a 2-year, you know, plan or anything. We were like, oh, this is a test. And if we want to kind of thrive as a community together, we need to communicate better. And so that was, I think you have these moments in life that are there to teach you. And if you're open to the lesson, I think they're amazing. And we were lucky that all three of us were at that stage. So that was an amazing experience, to be honest.
Mm. Wow. I imagine you came away with a lot of insights.
I think so. I think it was very, very interesting. And I learned a lot about myself.
I imagine, as most of us did. Mm-hmm. I think COVID was a turning point for a lot of us, mm-hmm. to start to question and reflect. When it comes to the topic of succession, I remember having a conversation with you, which really, really left me thinking about a lot of things. I always used to associate succession to something that was the natural process that would only happen in family businesses. But you talked about this idea of succession being part of a culture versus succession being part of a process, which does happen in corporations. We just, you know, we don't see it the same way, but it is the same thing.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between succession in a family business versus more of a procedural corporate environment, and what makes them the same and what makes them different?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I really came to that conclusion, I would say, probably about 8-9 years into my work with Tharawat. Because obviously, succession keeps coming up. And it keeps coming up in a way that is very specific. You know, who's going to be the next CEO? Who's going to be the next chairperson? And, you know, after a couple of sessions and we curated content, we did some research about it, I started thinking we're taking too much of a narrow approach to this, right? Because if all our focus is on who's going to be the next CEO or the next chairperson, we're disregarding all the other functions. And I think that's when kind of it clicked for me that succession, we look at it as a process, and it has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. It sometimes costs money. You know, it has certain standards, and when you do it well, you'll be fine. If you don't do it well, then your business is going to fail. Like, it's a very kind of polarized perspective of succession. When you look at corporates, it's obviously very different, right? Because usually shareholders, and I'm talking about multinational companies, usually shareholders, owners, don't work in those companies. So you don't have that personal relationship with the company. So you're not, whoever you are, you're just an equal non-shareholder. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a meritocracy in the best case. It's a meritocracy of how you kind of climb the ladder. And it's very natural that you will move from your position. So it's very logical that at some point you'll have to prepare a successor, mm-hmm. right? And so I think corporations, multinational corporations, have a much more systematic, a bit unemotional relationship with succession, whereas in family businesses, very emotional.
Mm.
And it's, interestingly enough, not just emotional with family members, but because family businesses have such a long-term perspective, we see a lot of long-term employees that also do not do succession planning for themselves.
Mm.
And that's when it clicked for me that succession is not a process. It is obviously also a process, but it's not only a process, it's a culture. And how does this culture look? This culture means that I need to realize that I am here for a certain amount of time. I can't change that. That is the reality of life. And if I take my role seriously and if I care about the work that I do, then I will be the one on the lookout for people who can replace me at whatever moment in time, whether I choose to leave, whether I have to leave, whether I get promoted, I get moved to another country. And I always make it an extreme example. I say, if you have a succession culture, even the intern that works with you for 3 months will care enough to say, who's going to take over my project after I leave? That is how deep, in my opinion, a succession culture should go. And if you succeed with that, then it's much less of a pressure on family members. Because then it's a natural occurrence. And there are debates and there are discussions and it's hard enough, right? Because yeah, ultimately there has to be decisions. Who's going to be in C-suite? Who's not going to be in the C-suite? It's difficult. But I think if you create a culture around it and not just focused on individual processes, it's much easier to carry.
Well, what's nice about it is that you end up doing what a corporation would do, which is prioritize the business and the legacy that you are building versus the individual.
And I think, I mean, I think you also prioritize the individual because mentally, it's much less of a do or die situation.
Mm, the burden's gone.
Oh, yes. Much, much less.
Mm, I didn't think about it like that. Because I do imagine that for some members of families, it does feel like a burden because the expectation is,
absolutely.
You know, whatever, the first child should follow in my footsteps and I've built this for you. And in some cases, maybe that's not even the life that they want. So, but the way that you talk about it, the conversation completely changes because then succession becomes about how do we continue the legacy of what we've built versus how do we keep our family name or leadership lineage alive,
mm-hmm.
which
look, I mean, it's very difficult because we deal with specifically, I would say, in countries that have high volatility.
Mm.
I will never disregard the fact that when you live in a country where there's high volatility, that you need family members involved.
Agreed.
It's just a fact.
Mm.
And I had to learn that here in the region, right?
Yeah. Especially because we are emerging markets. So there's a sense of community, loyalty. You need that network.
Absolutely.
And that tightness.
There's almost like a physicality to the network here in this region. And when you are not part of that network, it's not going to work.
You don't have enough at stake.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I think there are a lot of arguments of why in emerging economies, succession looks different. My father once wrote an article about succession of the network, and people don't do that consciously enough. We hand over paperwork, we hand over legal rights, we don't hand over networks.
Can you get into that? I'm not sure I quite understood it.
So what we mean by that is when you take over a family business, you don't just take over the operations, you take over what this company means to an entire community and how it's embedded into a community. And how it needs that community to thrive and to grow, right? So your stakeholders could be governments, communities, your supply chain, right? All of that is network. And we focus a lot on, you know, teaching you the job. But if we teach you the job without giving you the network, you can be as good as you want at a job. It's not going to work. Because you need to know where you stand in the value chain of the economy. And so this is where I feel like one of the aspects that we always try to motivate people to do is hand over your networks early enough. Get your next generations involved in important discussions and important conversations early enough, because that takes time.
I mean, I find that interesting because I find, you know, in my line of work, family businesses or family brands, especially that operate in different verticals, are the most challenging to work with. Not necessarily because of their internal culture, but because of those intergenerational disputes or opinions about how things should be run and what is their business, what they should focus on, how they should evolve. Have you faced any of those challenges, and can you speak on any insights that you drew from that?
Well, look, intergenerational conflict or disagreements is natural. Mm. I mean, we have them in families that don't have businesses, right? So imagine you take that conflict, and I always, whenever I speak to communities that are not in, or audiences that are not in family business, I'm like, well, you know, think of the most complex family relationship that you have. Now think of the hardest situation you've ever lived through at work. And now put those together every day of your life.
Yeah.
That is family business.
Mm.
And audiences that are not, suddenly they understand. They're like, oh, hang on a second. That is a level of complexity that's really, really difficult. The intergenerational thing is just one aspect that we have to look at. I've started looking at it more from a positive perspective at some point. Because I think that the fact that you have different generations who have to have those difficult conversations, right? It keeps everybody on their toes. It's hard. It's really hard. And it's really difficult. And, you know, I have experienced it myself. And it's unpleasant, right? But what it does is it challenges younger people to be better, because you need to be more convincing. It challenges senior people to stay on their toes and, you know, not miss a beat. In the best situation, it actually accelerates innovation and it improves the situation. In the difficult situations, it freezes you.
Absolutely. Right? And that's, I think that's the, I mean, that is the situation that I'm referring to, because what it does in many cases is it stops you from innovating, because the argument is it's working so well, it has for so long, why change? And does that change reflect those values that we ended up building? So I love the way you put it in terms of it helps the relationships develop, because they're you have someone you trust enough to consistently challenge you for the better, because again, the priority should be the business. But, you know, if things are working so well, why change? I mean, that's what ends up happening with a lot of my clients. So it's interesting, and I'm not sure how I would, like, how does one deal with that?
Well, to be very honest, one of the things that I've noticed is we always say family businesses are resistant to change
or evolution.
Change
is harsh or scary for them. I feel like even evolution is something that they're just apprehensive towards.
But I think in many situations, let's say there's a percentage that is absolutely true. They just don't want to change. That's absolutely fine. Or evolve. There will always be a percentage of that. But I think the bigger percentage, in my opinion, is that it's not that there's not a willingness to change. It's that there is a deep awareness of what that means to whom in the network that they exist in. Right? So when you look at the family business leaders that I admire, you know, and they're all amazing, amazing leaders. They think in networks. They don't think just for their own enterprise.
That's
right?
A good point. They consider everyone the family.
They have to consider the family.
Yeah.
They have to consider the employees that have been with them for decades. They have to consider the legacy that they've received, right? They have to consider the community they serve. They have to consider international regulations and how the marketplace is changing. So it's, I mean, I have to kind of defend leaders a little bit here, because we always, well, just change. Well, if you have 20 moving parts that you have to put into one basket at the same time to make sense of change, that is very, very difficult. And so it's easier from the outside, you know, we're like, yeah, but you know, when I sit on board, sometimes I'm like, come on. But then when I actually take a moment and I take a beat and I actually just reflect, where does the resistance comes from? Where does the resistance come from? I invariably find very good reasons. Now, I'm not saying that they are better than the reasons for change, but they are valid reasons. And I think what we tend to do is we tend to just gloss over that. We need to change. We need to innovate. And so that is the driving reality. And I think this is where, as a community that serves family enterprises, we need to check ourselves. And we need to reflect a little bit more. What are these leaders dealing with? And how can we be more supportive of the realities they're facing? Because if you're a business leader and you've led a successful company for decades, you're just not saying no to change just because. There is something behind that.
So interesting. And I mean, I don't even know how to say it, because I love how you put it. It's almost like, you know, part of what makes these legacies or these businesses special compared to these new age startups or entrepreneurial style businesses is the human aspect of it.
Absolutely.
You know, it's, we always hear it's not personal, it's business, but with them it is personal in every way. So it's an interesting, it's interesting to think about it from the perspective of balancing that, even in those conversations, especially with the businesses that literally have their name on the business. Interesting. I didn't think about it like that. But talk to us about Therawat. Exactly what is it as an organization, and how are you guys helping? Because I know that you're investing a lot in building case studies of businesses in the region, which I love. Can you tell us more about that?
Of course. So as I said before, Therawat is a nonprofit private sector platform. We function kind of like a, almost like a think tank. And the reason is that we really believe that a lot of the know-how on how to successfully run a family enterprise in the region needs to come from original research from the region. So one of our missions is really to contribute to the know-how around running a family enterprise in a Middle Eastern country. And so far, very often what happens is when we look at, for example, governance structures, many of those structures come from abroad. They come from outside the region, and they have not been adapted to the realities of our markets, of our economies, of our cultures. And so very often there's a kind of a mismatch. So one of our mission statements is really to kind of bridge between international best practice and regional realities. So that's kind of one of the important things that I think we do. In terms of output, what we do is we work on building networks for different communities within the family business community. So, for example, next generation members, right? We will talk about how to bring in a VC mindset, perhaps, to the family business. You know, how could that look? So those are questions that we address. We have a community for women in family business. And then we have more of a kind of boardroom level activities where we really speak to kind of the top level people and try to understand how their reality is evolving with all the factors that are involved. Then our second vertical is education. We believe very much that whilst there is a lot on offer in terms of educating business leaders in general, family business leaders a bit less, but more and more, there still are gaps of, you know, what is not being addressed. So we like to fill that gap. And the third main pillar is research. And this is really where all the questions that we are privileged to be able to ask, and this is why it's so great to be a nonprofit organization, right? Because we don't have a commercial agenda, we are free to ask questions that we think are really relevant to the community. And so, for example, we have one really amazing research project that has been going on for 6 years now with NYU Abu Dhabi, which is called Family Business Histories. And so we're mapping Menasa family business histories. And for example, we have 70 case studies on the website right now. And so what we're trying to do is to map the regional economic history through the eyes of family enterprise founders. So we go back 150 years, and through the evolution of the region, we track how these family entrepreneurs have evolved and built these legacies. So, and it has a multitude, in my opinion, of effects, this project. On the one hand, for individual families, it's like, oh, wow, you know, how am I connected to this? Like, we always get families that connect, that, you know, reach out to us and say, well, that's so interesting. My grandfather used to live here and talk to this guy. And, you know, so there's that kind of very natural connection. Number two, it raises awareness that if you are a multi-generational family enterprise, archiving and documenting your history is really important, because it's part of what you just said, that intangibility, that emotionality that is part of a family enterprise and that makes it so strong. Mm. I literally had a 100-year-old Lebanese family business on a panel recently, and we were talking about COVID.
Mm.
And then we were talking about the current situation in Lebanon. And the attendees were asking, how do you deal with that? And his answer was, I have 100 years of history to go back on and to take inspiration from. So if they manage to do that, then I can do this. So that is just one simple example of why, in a region where we shy away from history very often, your history is actually really important to inspire you. So that's the second reason. And the third one is really to document the richness of our region's entrepreneurial history, because it's completely underestimated. You know, like outside of the region, people don't acknowledge the incredible ingenuity of entrepreneurs in this region. And so I'm very proud that that is one of the projects that we do. Another project that we just started, I'm very excited about, is we're trying to understand the evolution of family capital in the region. So what does that mean? Traditionally, you have an operating family business, and that family business generates profits. And those profits are sent to the family, maybe invested a little bit on behalf of the family. You know, it's very loosely organized. Over the last few years, we've seen an evolution that families have started establishing what we call single family offices. So with the dividends, you have a structured approach to investing.
Okay.
And so, but it's a very, very, it's a bit of a Wild West situation, because people call all sorts of things family offices.
Yeah.
But why I'm personally so interested in it, because I think that the future of private capital is also the future of the regional economy, because where private capital goes influences what is going to be successful or not in this region. So if private capital is managed by non-regional people, then it's probably going to leave the region, and it's going to kind of behave in a very different way. Traditionally, a lot of the private capital still stayed in the region and kind of grew in the region. So how is that going to evolve? So we're very excited about this project.
That sounds incredibly exciting. I mean, so much of, I want to address so much of what you said. I mean, from the perspective of one, documenting our economical history, I think is incredibly important, because I had a conversation with a historian and researcher recently, and one of our biggest problems in the region is that our history, we very much relied on what the West has documented about us. And obviously, you know, the story belongs to the people who tell you the story, right? So I think it's very important. And I thank you for investing in a project like that. And I think when it comes to capital, I think that's such an interesting, especially with this generation that has come into wealth in so many different ways, but isn't as financially educated on how to invest it and where, how to do that, especially if they are linked to any sort of family business. I'm curious, do you think there are any inherent differences in the way that men and women approach financial investments in the region?
Oh, 100%. But I think it's not in the region. I think it's globally.
Okay.
I think we still are at the tail end of a very ingrained dichotomy, basically, in how finances are handled and how financial decisions are taken. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting, right? If we look back, let's say we look back 100 years ago in the Netherlands, you know, my great-grandmother, on both sides of my grandmother's family, two grandmothers, they were both doing the books. Like they were literally doing bookkeeping for their husbands.
Wow.
And that was a normal thing. Upper middle class, the women were managing the household budget and kind of helping behind the scenes with the administration of the business.
That is true, by the way, also in household. Yeah, that's actually, I never thought of it like that. But yes, they did have access to that kind of bookkeeping-like thing when it came to managing household finances.
Absolutely. So I always want to be careful that we don't say women have never had access to financial decision-making. That, in my opinion, is not true. Mm-hmm. I think women always took financial decisions. And until today, even in very traditional environments, you see women managing household budgets. But men managed the business budgets, right? Took the business financial decisions. My great-grandfather invested in some railway schemes and his wife was angry with him for 30 years because it was not a smart investment. Uh-huh. She would not have done it, but she was the preserver, right? He was the risk taker. And so I think that is where the problem starts, right? Is that as women, there is an inherent understanding is that your responsibility is to make sure that everybody has to eat, that everybody is clothed, that everybody can go to school. That is the purpose of your financial management.
Mm-hmm.
For men, because they were running the outside realities, it was investing to grow, right? Investing to expand. So I think there's a very clear blueprint of how we were taught as genders to invest. And I think now that we are in the 21st century where there's a complete kind of transformation of society, I feel our generation still has some of those remnants of, you know, preserve, be careful. Mm-hmm. And I think that ultimately has the result that women are seen as risk averse, you know, as not being very interesting financial decision makers. I mean, I can tell you, I was looking for family offices run by women. It was probably the hardest thing I've ever done.
I imagine so. Because one thing you have to keep in mind, you know, I agree with so much of what you're saying and you're giving me a lot of things to consider. But those limiting beliefs come from a very real space of women not having the kind of access and education that men may have in specific cases. And honestly, I hear this conversation coming up in so many different contexts, and I'm not quite sure what it's going to take, because you're right, we are in the 21st century now. We do have access to all types of education, even if we are late to the game when it comes to investment and being more financially savvy when it comes to our businesses. But what really needs to happen for things to change? Is it on more opportunities need to be available for women? Although I kind of have an issue with the quota issue, but we'll get to that. Or is it about, you know, women just need to kind of own up to it?
I mean, I always find it a bit hard to put all the burden on us.
I think
100%. I think it's a systemic thing. And I think that's how it has to be approached. For me, financial literacy is fundamental, not just between women and men. It's also between income classes. I think financial literacy has to become more widely, propagated across all sectors of society, because we underestimate how we could uplift a whole community just by teaching people how to deal with money. I think that's just as a basic statement, and that includes men and women. Now, when we talk about the kind of gender gap here, I think it's not just the education. It's the right to have experience and to experience financial decision making, and the right to make mistakes, and the right to improve your skill, and the right to improve your craft. Because there's a difference between being smart at handling your own money and becoming a financial professional, right? And there's a whole spectrum of kind of financial decision making in between. But what I feel, as women, we probably hold ourselves back as well. There is something to be said for women being a little bit more risk averse in general. And that means that we would never go through the learning phases that men have access to. So it's much more practical, I think, than educational, in my opinion. And so I think if we change that, if we allow women to, you know, to, you know, to do those investments and you know, make the mistakes that are being made every single day, right, in the market. I think that's going to change a lot.
I agree that it is going to change a lot. And I do agree that there may be a confidence issue when it comes to more women getting involved, especially in the VC space, by the way.
Absolutely.
But what do you think are the actionable steps that can be taken to foster a change? Like, what do we need to do? How can we contribute, you and I, as entrepreneurs? What can we do?
Well, if I had the answer, I would be somewhere else. But no, I think there's a lot of things we can do. I think, first of all, as women, we have to be allies with each other, right? We have to push each other. Like, it helps me so much when my co-founder, my sisters, my friends tell me, Farida, you know, just go for it. You know, we'll be there. We'll catch you if you fall. Like, just do it, you know, to encourage each other to take risks. I think that's amazing. And female support, when it comes from the right place, is incredibly strong. It's an amazing, amazing sense of solidarity that we can feel with each other. So I think that's really important. I think the UAE is doing an amazing job at speaking about the role of women in the economy in general as from a policy perspective.
I agree. I've seen it. I've been here for a year and a half and I feel it.
It makes a difference. It makes us feel different.
It makes us feel seen and considered.
And I can tell you, even in comparison to Europe, like the reality that ministers have as a talking point, the importance of gender balance in certain areas or industries, it just makes you feel like, yeah, I can do this. And that then kind of, we don't need much. I think that's also, people sometimes feel like, oh, we have to overhaul the whole. No, women just need a bit of encouragement.
Yeah.
And we need male support.
Yeah.
Right? We need those allies from men as well who think that financial and like decision making has very little to do with gender, has a lot to do with intellectual capacity, you know, capacity to see the world, to understand the world, to analyze what's happening. And I think that we can be very good at that. So we have the tools. It's just we need the access.
Okay.
I mean, VC investment in Europe, I hope I'm not misquoting the statistic, but I think there was a 2022 report that came out. I think 1.2% of all VC investment went to female-owned, female-led startups. 1.2.
That's incredibly disappointing.
I mean, like when I read it, I'll have to research more. I'll send you the real statistics if I misquoted it. But it was incredibly low. Mm. Incredibly low. And I think we're doing a bit better here in the region. Not much, but a bit better. But that encouragement is important.
I agree. So talk to me about the Women and Family Business Network. This is something that you've co-founded.
Absolutely.
What are you guys doing?
WAFB is a really, really cool initiative that we founded in 2014. And there's a funny little story attached to the founding of WAFB. I was at a conference in the US somewhere, and it was a family office conference. And it was a huge hotel, and I kept getting lost. And I kept taking the wrong elevators. And I was finally at the right elevator, and I must have looked really exhausted. And this lady comes in, and I recognize her from the conference. And she's like, "Are you okay?" I must have looked desperate. And I'm like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And we started talking in the short elevator ride, and I realized that she was a family business member from Colombia. And by that time, I thought, you know, women in the Middle East, I was buying into the narrative that we have a particularly hard time. But then she started telling me about Latin America, and I'm like, oh, very similar challenges, very similar opportunities. Like, why aren't we talking more about this? And so we started making that kind of South-South connection. And then I'm like, you know, we should do something about this. So I came home and I spoke to my sisters. I'm like, can we like do something about kind of women in family business, maybe South-South? But then we started talking to European family businesses. And they're like, hang on a second.
Same.
Wow. And so became a global thing. And so today we have a platform that's more like an initiative and a content platform where we publish the stories and the voices of female leaders in multi-generational contexts. So they could either run their family offices, family businesses, or a family foundation. And the whole point of WIFB is to kind of give a platform to a more diverse thought leadership. That's really what it is. Because when you do research about family businesses, I mean, I would say easily 75% of thought leadership is still, you know, male dominated. And so we want to kind of give a counterweight to that. And that's what WIFB does.
You know, with all this insight that you are developing into your organizations, whether it's Tharawat or the network, it's, you know, I know it's a nonprofit, but like, I feel like so much of these insights would benefit different industries within our economies in the Middle East. I'll talk specifically from a communication perspective. One of the biggest gaps that we have is that there's no investment in behavior, mindset, cultural nuances. When it comes to the people that we are communicating to, a lot of that data is based on things that we learn from Western or even Eastern communities. So I just think it's incredible that we have a treasure like this that exists that we haven't tapped into yet. Do people that are not part of these organizations have access to any of these case studies or any of these stories?
Absolutely.
They're all publicly available.
I would say 75% of what we do is publicly available, and for a good reason.
Mm.
Number one, all family businesses from all over the region, whether they're members or not, should have access to this. That's the whole purpose of our organization. And number two is exactly what you're saying. You know, it's we all come from family.
Mm.
Whatever the context, however much we are close to them or not close, we all come from family. We all have a certain collective behavior. That collective behavior makes or breaks us.
Mm.
And I think what we can learn from family businesses, and specifically from successful family businesses, is that an awareness of that collective behavior and that collective culture actually also counts in the workplace.
Mm.
And I fully agree with what you said. There has to be self-confidence, particularly in emerging economies, that we actually know how we work.
Yeah.
We know how we work. So we have the right to rethink systems that come to us and that are definitely successful and that we need to adopt, but we need to tweak in order for it to work for us.
100% work for us, but also contribute. You know, when we look at, I keep referring to the West or Europe or all of these external communities, they've been so influential to global economies. And I feel like we are just as worthy of contributing our insights, the way that we do things, because I think that we do have a role to play. And I think, okay, we are young compared to those regions, but I think we have a lot to share and they have a lot to learn.
I think we shouldn't say that this region is young at all.
Actually, that's a very good point. I take that back. I agree with you.
I think that's a fallacy. I think it's we self-deprecate ourselves.
We do.
And it's, yes, nation states might be young.
Correct.
But communities are thousands of years old.
Quite literally.
It's really interesting. People sometimes ask me to kind of talk about the evolution of kind of the economic realities in conjunction with family businesses. And then people expect me to start in 1971, now 72. And I start 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. Especially if we're talking about families, because those families historically, these civilizations, the way that they functioned as tribes, I mean, all of those learnings stem from that history. So I absolutely agree. Thank you for calling that out.
And then you see the cultural diversity as well.
Absolutely.
All the movement of people, the MENA, how it moved into each other and how everything is connected.
Yeah.
You know, it gives you a much wider perspective of who this region is. And that's why I think Family Business Histories is such an important project, because that's why it's freely available, because we want to show the world how absolutely amazingly rich this region is in terms of culture, in terms of religions, in terms of entrepreneurial prowess and capabilities. It's beautiful. But yeah, we have to say it. We have to say it ourselves.
I agree. We have to say it ourselves. We have to own up to it. And we have to acknowledge that we also have a pool to contribute from. I love that. Thank you. Let's talk about leadership. What do you think makes a good leader?
You have very easy questions, Dana.
I try.
Thank you.
I try.
You
I knew who to ask.
I'll give you exactly the... What makes a good leader? Oh my gosh. Honestly, I feel very shy answering this question.
Because, why?
Yes, because I think that good leadership is, on the one hand, complex and simple at the same time, I think. You know, there is a simplicity to it. But there's also, yeah, maybe let's start with that. I think there's a subjectivity to it. You know, what I deem a good leader might not be what you deem a good leader, might not be what, you know, a third person might deem a good leader. And I think specifically right now, you know, we have, I feel we are at the age of leadership crises. And we hear the word everywhere, the expression, right? Leadership crisis. So what does that mean? It means that we disagree with each other what makes a good leader. So that shows me that there is not one recipe, number one. So I, in all humility, I cannot tell you what is a good leader, but I can tell you what is a good leader to me. And a good leader to me leads with empathy. And I feel that we are lucky because we are starting to understand that kindness and empathy are not weaknesses, but it has taken a while. So leads with empathy, leads with purpose, because only purpose can lead to vision, right? People start with vision, but I think it's very hard to have a vision when you don't have a purpose. So for me, purpose comes first. Why? The why at the core, and then the how and the what kind of emanate from that.
Agreed.
And so for me, a good leader is someone who, on the human level, sees humanity, understands humanity, and can deal with individuals as well as groups of people. And at the same time, has that capacity to not just look into the future, but, you know, look at what they can do with the resources that are available to them for the betterment of society. That, for me, I would say are elements, at least, that, you know, combined give us hopefully a good leader.
I think that's a beautiful definition. I'd like to contribute mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a very similar definition of leadership from that perspective, especially when it came to kind of setting that vision and being the person that quite literally leads their team, their business, whatever it may be. In my specific case, that left me burnt out. That also left me with a strange sense of, what the hell am I doing? And questioning myself a lot, you know what I mean? And I learned very recently, especially because very recently, a lot of my own investment has gone into introspection, personal growth, reflection. I've learned that leadership very much stems from this humble idea that you are there to serve the people that are part of your organization or part of your team. And although it's such a, it's a very simple kind of way of summing it up, it's very, very profound to look at leadership as less about you dictating that path or, you know, forging that path, and more about serving others and figuring out how you are going to collectively make them better at what they do, so they are able to then kind of help you action whatever vision it is that you have for your own company. And I feel like the minute I started looking at it like that, it changed how I feel about myself. It changed how I held myself accountable to specific things. So yeah,
I like that a lot. And I think it's I can absolutely subscribe to that. I mean, personally, that's how I look at it. And it's interesting because I just certified as a director from the UK. And in the course, we had a leadership module. And it's specifically for boards of directors, of course, like how, you know, what leadership means for boards of directors. And it was so interesting that leading from behind and leadership as servitude almost is being now kind of pushed.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because our teacher or our lecturer said 10 years ago, that chapter would not have even existed.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's beautiful, right? That as a society, we evolved in a way that, and I do believe it comes because we have more diversity in leadership.
Mm.
Right? If you do not have diversity in leadership, I think questioning what good leadership is much less prevalent because you have a homogenous group that behaves in a homogenous way.
Correct.
And I think it's really great that kind of diversity has in leadership has brought us to the point of questioning what does that really mean. So I fully subscribe to that model. One thing I have to say, speaking about mental health, I think we have to be careful what that means to serve others.
Yeah.
Because even that can go overboard.
Very good right? point.
And I think we have to have boundaries. It can be a mental kind of a mindset that you're like, you know, I'm here, and it comes with that purpose, right? For me, doing something in service to others is because I feel that that is my purpose. So my purpose has to be clear, but I'm just a human and I need to make sure that I take care of myself.
Absolutely.
And so I think here is kind of a bit of a tension, you know, between these big ideals, and I feel them myself, right? You want to do everything for everyone and everywhere. You want to make positive change, but we're just a biological creature and we have limitations. So I think that's very important that we, whilst we are enthusiastic about all those, you know, ideals, how do we deal with them on a day-to-day basis without burning out?
You're absolutely right. And I'm glad that you said it. It kind of goes back to that age-old example about the plane. You have to put the mask on yourself, the oxygen yes. mask on yourself yes. before you put it on the child or anyone else.
100%.
And I think that comes with choosing to serve, whether it be in leadership or whatever it is that you do. You know, it brings with it so much satisfaction. There's a satisfaction that comes from giving, but you can't give from an empty cup. And I think that's important to note. Going back to the idea of leadership in legacy businesses, we talked about this idea of intergenerational struggles when it comes to evolving the business. What about when it comes to poor leadership? That's something that in some cases can almost become a toxic culture in an environment of a business. And it almost becomes something that not even the family, but the employees inherit. And that can almost, you know, make a business stagnant. And I'm curious, what are your thoughts on how to navigate poor leadership in legacy businesses?
Look, it depends who you are. It really depends who you are. If you're an employee and there is a culture that does not correspond with your value set, go, leave. Because it is very, even in non-family businesses, right? We have a lot of cultural issues and values issues in startups, right? We continuously hear about these highly valued financially valuation, you know, high financial valuations, but then the culture is just horrible, right? So it happens everywhere. I think in that case, you know, try not to stay longer than you mentally can deal with. Now, where it becomes difficult is when you're a family member, right? Because you're linked to that. You're on the one hand linked to it by your name, but you're also emotionally somehow involved in this whole situation. So that takes a whole different weight. And especially I see it when people, for example, feel that the business is really mismanaged and is not doing well and, you know, is on the brink of collapse. Which, look, I recently provoked my audience a little bit. I was moderating a panel and I asked the audience what they thought the average lifespan of a company was. Because, you know, we very gallantly speak about, oh, family business and they have to do this and that. And it was very interesting and they gave me some numbers. And so there's a McKinsey research that said, that looked at the age of S&P 500 listed companies. And in the 1960s, it was about 60 years. So that was kind of the average lifespan of these companies. And today it's 18.
Wow.
So the lifespan of companies has reduced drastically. So what are we expecting? So imagine a second generation family business has already outperformed, right? Just by skipping that one generation, outperformed. So you're already older than your expected lifespan as a company, right? So what do we expect What is realistic to be expected from legacy businesses? How long do you have to sustain? And how long is it realistic? And it's such a fast changing world to sustain. So I think it's also a question of what do we hold on to? And we have to be strong enough to ask ourselves that question. Mm-hmm. And it's a very hard question.
It is.
For entrepreneurs, for family business members, what are we holding on to? Is it healthy for us to hold on to it? And are we capable of dealing with it if we want to transform it? Those are the questions I think that matter. Bad leadership, you can find anywhere, and it's always difficult to deal with. The question is, why are we holding on? What are we trying to do? And how do we get a consensus in the collective that we want to do better?
We've talked about you being a global citizen. And, you know, I share in that experience. I also come from a mixed background. I've lived abroad. My English is definitely more proficient than my mother tongue, especially when it comes to the way I articulate myself when it comes to business and things like that. When it comes to the diversity you have within your own family, the cultures that you've been exposed to and the languages that you can speak, how have those factors, or have they, contributed to making you a better leader?
So first of all, the assumption is that I am somewhat of a good leader.
I mean, I think you are. Hold on. To be fair, can I just tell one story?
Of course.
I was never meant to meet Farida, okay? The reason I met you is because I met one of your co-founders, and I was just asking her about your business, and, you know, her and I clicked, and she was adamant. She is like, the person that you need to speak to is our CEO and fellow co-founder, Farida, because she is incredible at what she does. Like, she had incredible things to say about you. And to be honest, I had no doubt that you would live up to the expectation, but when I met you, you surpassed it. So yes, I say that very confidently. I imagine that you are a good leader. I'm not assuming that you're perfect. We all have things to work on, but I imagine that you are a very good leader.
So the sample is 2 out of 9 billion, which is you know, it's a good start. No, I think maybe what I'm happy to answer is how those factors have influenced my leadership style, I guess. Mm. You know, I think that is where it's everything. It is everything. I think everybody's background, if we're honest, impacts how we lead and you know, what we perhaps are better at or less good at. And for me, what's always been important is that everybody feels seen in our companies. And I am adamant that, you know, everybody adds value. Our last meeting, founders meeting, we spent half an hour speaking about the cleaner in the factory.
I love that.
And that's one of, you know, about 24 employees. Mm. But why do we spend 30 minutes speaking about the cleaner? Is because he adds value. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't, it's noticeable. And I want to give him a chance and I want to sit down with him. And so we sat down with him and we spoke to him about what it meant to be working at Kima and why it's important what he does, and that we believe he can do better. But if he's also free not to work with us if it's too much. And so I think the fact that I come from the background that I come from, where perhaps as a child, you know, the battle for acknowledgement and the battle for acceptance, maybe more acceptance than acknowledgement, is a hard one. And I think we put ourselves in human society, we eradicate the value of the individual and we focus on either pigeonholing them or kind of just glazing over. And I think for a well-functioning business, obviously I cannot spend half an hour on everybody every week, but I think it's a symbol. It's a symbol that we care, and it's a symbol that we see. And it's a symbol that we believe that everybody has value to add. And then, obviously, it's the private sector. We need to be profitable doing that. And so we all have to have the same mission. And so I think also putting a clear vision and a path to achieving, you know, our mission is very important as a leader. Because I think that's, when I look around, I feel sometimes that's missing. And again, being in the UAE, you know, you see the value of a clear vision.
Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that.
It's very simple.
I've literally built my entire business based on that, because aside from just having a vision and a path, I love that you referenced, you know, even the clean air, because I think everyone contributes to that. It is not limited to the people sitting at the boardroom table. It is not limited to the C-suite, and it's definitely not on the sole shoulders of the CEO, which is a common misconception.
And it's not on the sole shoulders of the people who execute.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Sometimes you have those dynamics as well.
Correct.
So I think we have to be very vigilant of what type of culture we have in our organizations and uplift each other if we can. And, you know, the thing is, they uplift us, right? If I invest in people, the most beautiful moments was when I did not expect it. Someone was like, you know what? Let's do this. Like, we can do this because this, let me take responsibility. I recently had an employee come to me and say, Farida, please give me more responsibility. I'm ready. I can do this.
I love that.
And I mean, that was just a beautiful moment, right?
See, told you you're a good leader. And then came Kima. Kima, Kima, Kima.
Yes.
I want to talk and hear about Kima. It represents one of your most recent ventures. You already referenced your two co-founders, the fact that they're your friends and you've actually worked as family businesses before. They've worked in their own family businesses and now you guys collectively together. They're also women. So it's a female-founded business, which I think is beautiful. And you've built this entire business around a purpose or a proposition for good. The whole premise of Kima is cleaning supplies that are also sustainable and contribute to leaving the world a little bit better than how you found it.
Absolutely.
Can you talk to us about the inception of the idea and why you chose a sector that is
hard?
Hard. Exactly. It's very competitive. It's incredibly competitive and you're starting from scratch. So please tell me.
Yeah, we like to make our lives difficult.
I mean, you definitely like a challenge. Yes.
I would say yes, that summarizes my life. So Kima was a really interesting story because it was kind of born out of a combination of factors. So my two co-founders, Dima Saman and Samar Sayer, and I kind of were in a place in 2019 where we're like, you know what? We've been working in our functions for a long time and we didn't know COVID was coming. So obviously that was, if I had known COVID was coming, I don't know if I would have done the same thing. But so this was 2019, the world was okay. And we're like, you know what? Let's sit together and see, you know, if there's something we can do together. And then very quickly, it kind of showed that sustainability was, you know, an aspect. And let's say environmental sustainability was an aspect that the three of us were very keen on. And one of the things that I noticed very early on moving here to the UAE from Switzerland is the amount of trash that we generate just by living a very normal, decent, humble life, right? And I think this is where the main motivator came, is that we suddenly realized, hang on a second, isn't there a way to re-engineer products to make them less heavy on the planet? The customer should not compromise on quality, should not compromise on affordability, and it should not be cumbersome, right? So we went through so many iterations because we're like refilling, but you know, it's cumbersome, right? You have to take your empty thing, you have to wash them and then bring them to the shop. So we went through a lot of models that we thought about. And then one day I remember we were walking through one of the mega supermarkets here and we ended up in the cleaning aisle and we were walking through and it felt like a kilometer of cleaning products, right?
It is.
It's like never ending. It's almost
literally
like a horror movie. And we were walking and suddenly one of us said, look, imagine all of this in about a month is going to end up on the landfill. All the plastic bottles are going to end up on the landfill. And we're like, yeah, but the plastic bottles are actually absolutely fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with them. It's just the product that's done. So we're like, okay, we're going to find a way to work on this. So we got inspiration from a US company that's doing a very similar concept. And we're like, you know what? We're going to make tablets that you can dissolve in water. Mm-hmm. So once you're done cleaning, and your product is finished, you just refill the bottle with water, you put in a tablet, you wait 5 minutes, and you have a new cleaning product. And that's basically how Kima started. And then we thought that it was going to be easy, and it wasn't. And what was hard was interesting. What was hard was finding the chemists.
Mm.
Yeah, because I always say, you know, I grew up in Switzerland. I pick up a stone, I throw it, I hit a scientist, right? It's very densely populated with scientific, you know, people. Here, because there's not that many R&D centers in the region.
Correct.
You don't have that many chemists.
Yeah.
So I found myself in 2019 desperately looking for chemists. So yeah, that was the beginning of chemo.
Wow. That's an incredible story. And you found your chemist, obviously.
We found about four.
Okay, nice. Very, very cool.
Yes.
Did you import them or you found them here?
So we found the first one was here. The second one was also here. Then the third one came from the US. And now the fourth one is also here. So it's, you know, everybody is a little different. And we hire for different reasons, right? Mm-hmm. So you hire for either experience in multinationals or you hire for a kind of proficiency in formulations. It really depends.
Okay. When it comes to this business, though, aside from it being super competitive and incredibly difficult because obviously you have an actual facility that manufactures this, it's not as sexy as a tech business. Tech businesses tend to get a lot of attention, especially in the VC space. So I'm curious, while funny enough, a business like yours probably represents a larger footprint in the region when it comes to category, are you facing struggles when it comes to VC support or investments or things like that?
So very early on, we decided we're not going to go for VC funding.
Really?
Because...
May I ask why?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It was very clear that VCs are not going to invest in us in the region specifically. Mm-hmm. Like in Europe and in the US, you have some examples of VCs who invested in this type of company, in a hardware company that has manufacturing. The example was that, for example, in Germany, the companies that got VC funding were not manufacturers. So they were more brand building companies. So that was what was invested in. So they would white label the manufacturing. We have the manufacturing in-house and the R&D. Mm. So it's a bit of a heavy business. And it's a slow business, right? Because to make a mark in an FMCG sector is very, very difficult. So what we opted for is to go for investment by a family office that actually has a manufacturing background.
Okay.
So why we did that is because we very early noticed we needed someone who understands manufacturing. We needed someone who understands physical products and how physical products move through the supply chain.
Mm.
So, and that was the best decision we've made. And we are very, very lucky with our investor because they not only support us financially, but they could also give advice, right?
And you went and pitched your idea to them. It's not like they found you.
No.
Okay, so you picked them.
It was organic. I'm not going to lie. It was organic. We were very lucky.
Okay.
But it was very intentional that we said we are not going to go for VC.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the right decision. It's not, as you said, it's not as fancy perhaps when people, you know, it's very fancy to have a VC investor.
Mm-hmm.
it sounds amazing, yeah. Right? But I think for us, it was the right decision not to do that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the fact that it represents something that is a little bit smaller than maybe your other ventures, what does it mean to you?
Oh, it means a lot. Oh my gosh, I've learned so much. This is kind of my purpose of existence is just learning, right? I'm just curious by nature. And to suddenly find myself as a lawyer... and as someone who's always been in services, suddenly find myself next to a machine trying to figure out why it wasn't working.
Mm.
I mean, obviously we had engineers there, but like I then want to be there and I want to understand. And my co-founder, Samar specifically, I mean, she's amazing. She is incredible. And she has absolutely, you've met her.
Yes.
And so she has this fearlessness when it comes to manufacturing. Without her, I would not have done this. And so she helped me kind of get close to our product. And so it's the first time that I have a physical product, and it was like a mini MBA. I've relearned business.
That's incredible.
And I think that's really cool. When you jump sectors, you become so much better at everything else as well, because you see the economy in a different way.
And you also get this new, like, rush of energy.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
for
absolutely.
Me, it really, I've learned in my experience that it kind of gives me that rush to kind of go that extra mile again, to 100%. Start over, to restart. It's a beautiful energy.
100%.
One of the things that I do a lot is I think about the woman that I am today and I think about the woman that I want to be. And I try to get an idea of what it's going to take for me to get there. what it's going to take for me to become her. And it's interesting because the more I ask myself these questions, the more introspective I get, the more I do things that help me reflect, the closer I feel I am becoming that woman that I want to be. And I very much enjoy that process. So I'm curious about you. Tell me about the woman you are today versus the one you would want to be. And are you close to her? Is she someone that you're still trying to define?
Very interesting question. So I recently was very happy to realize that in essence, I'm still very much the 16-year-old me. And that was beautiful to notice because, yeah, I've changed a lot. Obviously, you know, life teaches you lessons and you mature. But in essence, my belief systems, my ethics are exactly what they were when I was 16 and, you know, super active and involved in all sorts of schemes and things. So that was nice. I was very happy with that because I think that that means that those aspects define me. And so when I realized that, I'm like, okay, so what does this mean for my next evolution? Because I think the last 15 years, so I would say my studies marked me a lot. So when I became a lawyer, a barrister, you know, you go through a lot already to kind of get there. And I think that refined my sense of structure, my approach to things, made me analytical. And then the next 15 years of Wild West entrepreneurship and, you know, creating things from scratch that did not exist before. Because before, when you work as a lawyer, you exist very much, you function within an existing system. The next 15 years were create your own system, right? And I think that was amazing. That was very exhilarating. And I think the next 15 years are probably going to be based around creating more opportunities for others. I think that that, for me, is the essence of entrepreneurship. Because it's not about me. It's about what we can do as a community. And if I could have one wish, is that I can do more of what I do with more people and give more people platforms around me. Because there are incredible humans in this world. And we sometimes, I think, are so absorbed by what is happening on the planet that we forget to celebrate who is amazing. And I mean, that is a dream, you know, is to work alongside these amazing people.
That's beautiful. You know, your positivity is infectious. Dax, are you smiling? I can't stop smiling at her. Perida, I want to end this episode on a final question. This is something I ask all of my guests. What would you, based on the conversation that we had today, want to ask me? What would you like me to consider?
That's a very interesting question. I think, I mean, I really have a lot of admiration for what you have done.
Wow. Thank you. Wow.
Absolutely. I think you've, you know, what you've built, how you've transformed what you've built, and then also how you took risks to say, I open a new chapter. I think that is incredible. I would probably, you know, ask you how you will share that experience with the world. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's an incredibly valuable experience, what you've been through. And I know you do your podcast, but I think it's a lot about what other people are doing as well. And I think, you know, we could all benefit from your experience and how you've so gracefully navigated these transitions. So that would be my question to you.
Wow. First of all, that's a very, very kind thing to say. And that means a lot coming from you, honestly, because I admire you so much. How would I document it? I definitely feel like the podcast is part of that journey to figuring it out. But I also feel like the podcast is something that is evolving in terms of what it represents, what it means to me, and what type of content I produce with it. I definitely do want to write about it, but I think more than write about it, it's influencing the type of company I am building now. I am being faced with so many opportunities that are challenging me to question whether I'm going to repeat the same, I don't want to call them mistakes, but repeat the same decisions that I've made in the past because they're more comfortable, because I can expect what will come of them. And that predictability feels good. But also, do I want to do something else? And, you know, it's one thing to take a risk and kind of turn a page, start a new chapter in your life. It's another thing to commit to it. And I feel like the type of company that I'm building now is a commitment to me making different decisions that are going to be leading me somewhere new. And that is the type of story I want to tell. I want to be able to have an output of what taking those risks can actually produce. So that is my hope as to how I share that story. I need it to be something, I need the product to be something more concrete than me writing it or saying it. I need to be able to say, this was the result of it.
No, and I think, you know, it's like with every life experience, the output should not be a static output. I think that's very important. We tend to have that idea of like, I'm going to write her autobiography, right?
Yeah. So,
which is great, but I think that's not where it should stop.
Yeah.
And I think it's beautiful that you're basically taking this as a new principle or as a new kind of foundation.
Quite literally.
For what you're doing next. So I'm very excited to see what's to come.
Me too. Farida, you've given me so much to consider.
Well,
thank you so much for being on the show. Honestly,
pleasure.
It was a beautiful conversation.
Thanks, you. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
If our audience are interested in reaching out to you or working with you, what are the best ways to reach you or connect?
So the best ways would probably be LinkedIn.
Okay.
So you can always find me on LinkedIn. I'm quite responsive there. And of course, I'll send you some links maybe that you can share to the research projects. So
amazing.
If people want to check out the History Project, for example, it has a really beautiful database of amazing, amazing stories. So I can really encourage people to visit that.
Amazing. I'll make sure to include them in the show notes.
Fantastic.
As always, I want to thank you all for the privilege of your time. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to like or comment. I love reading your feedback. And don't forget to follow or subscribe to the page that you're currently listening to this episode on. It really helps grow the platform and grow the podcast in general. Thank you, and I hope you found something to consider.